I'm Reggie.
And I'm Brian.
And this is R&B Talks. Talks a lot.
We talk.
We do a lot.
It's the ball swivelly majigger over here. I don't know exactly. I still can't remember the name of this.
Marvelous.
Marvelous.
The electro roll.
Marvelous.
Yeah, it's so it's got this, you know, they give instructions in it to like, well, if you have problems with the marbles and they go off the track, you need to do this. It's kind of a, I don't know why, like, I get it because it's small probably, but like having to adjust the track all the time, which I do all the freaking time. If I see something, it's really annoying. So
price you pay, dude, for wanting a marvelous.
Yeah, well.
I noticed you're smoking a mightily beautiful new brown and royal blue pipe. It's very colorful and ostentatious.
It's quite a large bulldog pipe, okay, as they call it.
That's called a bulldog pipe? I did not know that.
This shape is a bulldog. The only, let me think here.
It's very bulbous.
It has like one interesting little thing in here on the stummel. So you have like this part of the pipe that's really like the main part called the stummel. This is really like the bit or
the bit.
Yeah. That's what they call it, really.
Sorry.
That's mouthpiece, funny. Whatever. Right. But this has got it's a really cool shape, and I like, it's very, very fat. Like that. I mean, like, I don't know if they can probably not see that, but that thing's, you know, my thumb obviously is, if you don't know, it's rather large, but it's not even, it's wider than my thumb, which is odd, but I like it.
Well, you need a wide bit
for my big mouth.
Yeah.
Oh, Paul's Pipes did it again. So he's pretty good dude. And I appreciate patronizing him, I guess. He does a really good job.
Well, especially if you're getting something that's worth your patronage, right?
Yeah, I mean,
like, there's nothing worse than patronizing someone. Or actually, there's nothing worse than being referred to patronize someone and it winds up being hot garbage.
Well, too, look, like, when you're talking about small pipe makers,
mm-hmm,
like, you know, they're not, it's not like they're selling, you know, 50 pipes a day kind of thing. I mean, it's like, you know, it takes them a good while to even make one pipe, and then, you know, it's that kind of thing. So, you know, if they're established, they've been making for a while, they're hundreds of dollars.
Yeah.
And they take a lot of time to do that. So it's like it's a big deal. With Paul, I've bought some pipes that, like, The one I cherished that I thought was the most awesome pipe ever ended up going back to him because it was leaking and it couldn't be fixed. And we had this whole thing and he sent me another one. And so, I mean, at the end of the day, we worked it all out, but it was only because he was like a very concerned and he really cared about, you know, how happy I was with my purchase and everything. Mm-hmm. It all worked out, you know, because we ended up coming.
Because he probably takes pride in what he does.
Yeah.
Right.
But also, too, I probably have a whole drawer full of just Paul's pipes, you know. I mean, mm-hmm, he's one of my favorite pipe makers that I really like to buy from. So, and really anymore, I have so many.
Did you have enough pipes for all your pipes to have pipes?
I do.
Like, I've never seen that many pipes. Well, what I'm willing to gamble is that you have smoked out of all of them.
Yeah.
That's insane to me.
Well, no. Okay. There is some I haven't. I have some, what they call estate pipes that I bought from, I don't remember. They're still in a box that I've never even got out. But it was like one of those, like, you know, auction things. So I cleaned a couple of them up because they were really cool. But yeah,
I saw a pipe the other day that the bulbous part of the pipe, we're going to call it, because I can't remember what you called it. A stummeler. Is that what it was? A stummel was made of ivory.
You sure it was ivory and not meerschaum?
No, this was an ivory. It was like 150 years old. Like it was in a museum, and it was the pipe of some novelist. It was solid ivory with a black bit on it, and it was, and it had like hand carvings in the.
Well, usually that's meerschaum. They call it meerschaum because it's like, this is actually meerschaum. Okay. It's out of Turkey, and it does, it's like a, almost like a clay.
Okay.
It's almost rock. You know, it's, it is supposed to, well, I don't even know how to describe it. Like, it's a very carvable. See, my, it's that's going to drive me nuts. So we're
I think if I read correctly, they said that if that pipe was purchased nowadays, price wise, it would be the equivalent of like 60 grand. For a pipe.
Yeah, the ivory, you can't even get ivory anymore.
So. Yeah, it was in a British museum, and I can't remember who the author was, but he smoked the ivory pipe whilst writing his bejeweled and loved novellas. I don't even know if those are the right terms. We're just being fancy.
One of my favorite like adornments to a pipe, like the accoutrement, as it were. Is mammoth. They use like a mammoth tusk or something, and they put a ring on it or something like it. Use it for decoration. It's freaking cool. So I'll get out.
Yeah,
it's really neat.
Have you ever thought about making pipes, Reggie?
Yeah, but I don't have the tools or woodworking knowledge to really make that. You know, I actually have like a project pipe that my in-laws bought me for Christmas one year, and I have like a I guess you call it like a carving or whittler's folding knife that has like a bunch of different edges on it that I've been every once in a while, I'll pick it up and like whittle it down with just hand by hand, you know? So I am doing that one, but that's just for giggles.
That's for gits and shiggles.
Yeah. It's not really for, you know, not anything serious. I did talk to, I don't know. Are you familiar like Maker 13 or something like that? Where it's like you pay a monthly membership and they have like, you can go use their facilities. And it's like, they got like CNC machines and any kind of woodworking machine
or metalworking machine.
You can take classes to learn how to weld or take classes to learn how to run the CNC machine and all this stuff. Like you can learn all that stuff there and you pay like a monthly membership or whatever. I thought about doing that and then like taking like a class on wood turning and all that stuff, but it's time. I just don't have it.
You have time.
Well, you know what? Today, like, here's an example. Like I knew only I got up. I had to. My brother has his daughter's birthday party, which was going to have pizza, and I volunteered to like, no, dude, just give me a couple of pieces of meat, and I'll put them on my smoker and. You can do that, and it'll be not only better, but it'll be, you know, a hell of a lot cheaper than trying to buy pizza for everybody, right?
Yeah.
So he did that. So I got up and did my smoker thing and got all the ready and put it on the smoker and all that stuff. And then I got – grabbed my 8-pound splitting maul and went to town on some sections of log to split and then cut some grass and – yeah. So,
all right.
I don't have time for Maker 13 really right now, but I do have marks on my overalls from Max and his slobber.
That's okay. He's coming along well.
He's a slobber machine, man.
He's very kind now that he's kind of chilled. I mean, he barks, but before it was a fearful bark, and now it's like a bark of, hey, what's up, man? How you doing? You know?
Dude, it takes, so they say, at least 3 months for a dog to like, transition and like and get comfortable with a new home. Usually though it's like 6 months to a year.
Yeah.
Depending on the dog and issues and stuff. So we're happy. I mean it's not like we're upset about anything. So
he's got a big old head.
Oh he's huge.
He's got a monster noggin. He is the nogginator.
How did I get pipe tobacco in my coffee, dude?
Probably because you're smoking pipe tobacco and you drank from it.
Yeah,
and
but I wasn't even close to this.
Pipe tobacco in the you know proximity flavor. Things.
Flavor.
So how was the past week? Full of vim and vigor, I assume, since you were 8-pound wood maul splitting and smoking of the meats. And
well, so what I did, okay, let me, I'll explain this splitting maul, right? I wanted to start doing something that I would do every day. To like keep myself somewhat
active.
Yes.
Got it.
And splitting wood was one of those things I always enjoyed. It's mindless. You're freaking beating the living snot out of some wood.
Yep.
So I have a couple really nice felling axes that I have, and I just used that before. Well, so I was out there this week with my felling axe, just trying to split this wood. Well, the wood's been out there for like 8 years. It's very, it's almost nice, petrified.
Petrified, yeah.
And even some of it was just rotten. I just throw it to the side or whatever. So the felling axes and I keep them really sharp. So they were just like, you'd take a whack and it would stick so solidly into that thing. You would be like, man, and it would take, and you couldn't just plop it up or anything like you normally could. It's like, you have to take another hammer. And so that got old. And I thought, well, the wood's just too old. I'm just going to have to do something else. But then I thought, well, you know what? These are felling axes. And so if anybody's not familiar with this, like the difference between some of these things is all about the angle of the way it cuts and also the way it goes through the wood. So and like
thickness of the blade as well.
Yeah. So a splitting maul or like a splitting axe will have like a much greater and longer taper than like a felling axe would. A felling axe you're really used to, you're really chipping away at a tree, mm-hmm. and you want that to be able to really slice through there. You're not trying to like split it apart.
Yeah.
With the felling axe or a small, you're like, you got a very defined, it's almost like a big wedge you're slamming so into.
In the back of it almost looks like the back of a sledgehammer.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Especially the eight pound one is pretty much a sledgehammer with a blade on one side. So I got that thing. I was going to buy one. I like a couple different brands on, like Adler and Holtzberg, I think is what they're called, and a couple of different Swedish companies and Nordic companies or whatever that they make some really cool hand forged, but they're expensive. And I was like, man, I don't really. Anyway, local hardware store had a wood handled 8 pound splitting maul, and I picked up. And I'll be damned. I got home. And I was like, okay, let's see if this does anything. And I come to that piece of wood. I lift that thing, give her hell. And that wood just goes, it was awesome. It was
split
like,
split right down the middle.
Oh, dude, split. Yeah. And so if I swing that thing, it doesn't really matter what's there.
Here's a question.
Split.
Reggie, I have some axe knowledge. You ready for this?
I am ready.
Why does a splitting wedge have a flat back?
You mean like a splitting maul or something?
Have a flat back.
Well, it doesn't have to, but you can do that. You can use this.
But you know why they have them, right?
You can use it with a hammer.
Well, it's because when woodsmen were in the forest and they wanted to split a larger log, say a log, you know, big enough to put around your arms around, and the splitting wedge was not enough, the other guy would turn his splitting wedge and use the back end on top of the one that was in the wood to help them split axe. I found that out watching a documentary about lumberjacks. That's right. Lumberjacks.
They don't do that really much anymore, man.
Only mostly in Canada.
I mean,
Canada still has a fair lumberjack population.
Well, the Pacific Northwest does. You find a lot of guys out there.
Yeah.
But also too, I mean, there's a bunch of dudes around here that do a lot of firewood.
Yeah.
You know, they cut it, but our trees aren't that near as big as you get to the stuff out there. Now we'd have some pretty big oak trees.
Yeah. One of the most impressive things I ever saw was in Washington State as we were driving towards Bellingham, which is northern Washington. There were trees. This is not a game. Me and you and both of our wives and all of our kids could stand around these trees holding hands and not get all the way around the tree.
Oh, yeah, I know.
It was nuts how big around these trees were.
They say that the redwood forest there, they've even said that the root system gets intertwined between the trees. So it's almost like one living organism that just has all these huge trees. Yeah. That's crazy, man.
Useless knowledge. Did you know the largest living organism in the world is in Portland? It's a mushroom.
No, but
it covers like, I think they said like 8.5 acres from end to end, square acres of, and it's one organism.
Huh.
Isn't that crazy?
Useless knowledge by Brian
Plenty Kirby. Of useless knowledge. Yeah, useless knowledge today. Nice. As everyone can tell, this one, is not behaving. I have allergies. Sucks. I'll get over it.
Before we launch into something,
okay,
why don't we have a Edwards Managed Technology Computer Consulting take a gander at what they got?
I like it. Go after it, Edwards Managed Technology Consulting.
Computer consulting.
Go.
Picture this, Brian. You're out with the fellas, and you get a call from mom. What's that, mom? Your printer's acting up again? I'll be right there.
Reggie, we all love mom, but wouldn't it be great if just this once we could send someone in your place?
Sure would.
At Edwards Managed Technology Computer Consulting, rest assured that they'll take care of mom, dad, brother, sister, and even that one aunt with all the cats.
Don't feel bad sending your loved ones to voicemail. Just make sure you text them about Edwards Managed Consulting. They fix computers, printers, and so much more.
Visit www.emtcc.net to make an appointment or give us a call at 1-888-551-2770. Mention R&B Talks for your 10% off your appointment. Remote and on-site options available.
Thanks, Brian. Thanks, Edwards. And we are back.
Reg, you said something. We talked about something in the last episode that was very interesting. And you had, in our texts back and forth today, you had brought it up again, and that was Jezebel.
Okay. Well, So there's one thing I wanted to just clarify is that there really was a biblical – there really was a historical person named Jezebel. She was queen with the king
Ahab,
right? Mm-hmm. And so it's not like she was a demon, but what she did was she promoted the worship of Baal, and she like actually brought that into that part.
She brought it into Israel.
To Israel. Yeah. And she was very much was into all kinds of weird sex stuff.
I think I got some. Okay, so Jezebel was denounced as a murderer, prostitute, and an enemy of God. Yet there is much to admire in this ancient queen and her power, because after her marriage to King Ahab, Jezebel emerges as the power behind the throne. Jezebel was infamous for several things: persecuting the prophets of Yahweh, instituting worship of Baal in the Israel temples, trying to have the prophet Elijah killed, and framing and executing Naboth to get his vineyard.
Yes.
So she was very scandalous. She's scandalous.
Well,
she's trifling.
So when you hear like Mark Driscoll say stuff like the Jezebel spirit, it's coming from like the way what she was into and promoted.
Yes.
But it's not like so and this is why I was kind of I wanted to bring this back up about demonic things. Like maybe there is a demon named Jezebel, but I don't know. And it's not like that, but there is definitely demonic forces that rule over those type of ungodly vices or characteristics. So I just wanted to, I really just wanted to make that point. Right.
Well, I am looking something up
because I think I want to dig into angels and demons in another episode I want to really dig into that quite a bit because there's a lot out there and the truth of that, or what I would perceive the truth to be, is it's a little different.
There's no listed demon by the name of Jezebel.
Okay. So
just for the sake of
now, could she have been possessed or something by that kind of spirit and, you know, blah, blah, blah. I don't know. But that's, I just wanted to clarify that there was a actual person named Jezebel that did a bunch of very heinous things and was very, it was evil. Right. I mean, let's put it out there and just say the truth. She was evil. So, I mean, that's what he was talking about, is that sexual desire and sexual immorality, lust, that kind of thing was Jezebel's bag, you know, and deceit, murder, those kinds.
Well, I'm looking.
She was brilliant, you know?
Well, you know, she knew how to.
Look, no, I wouldn't say, but when they said, but something to admire. Well, okay, no.
Well, I think that came from a secular website. Part of that definition came from a biblical website. But, you know, you say angels and demons, and I kind of got into studying this, and I got into studying the Nephilim, which the Nephilim in popular culture are depicted as descendants or offspring of demons, fallen angels, and human women. The Nephilim of Genesis 6 have become a notable motif. This interlinks with our similar motifs regarding Christian demons and popular culture. I think that there are. Do I think that angels intervene on behalf of God? Well, biblically they do, right? And they don't do it. You know, angels intervened on the behalf of God when informing Mary and Joseph of the coming of Christ. Angels came to Abraham. All of these things happened, right? So do I believe that there is intervention of angels? Absolutely. Now, what does that look like? That's a whole nother conversation, right? I mean, you know, the popular term guardian angel, right? I don't know if that has any weight or merit. I've never studied it. I do know that angels are actually God's army, right? I mean, when the battle was fought, it was the angels that fought on the field of battle, right? So I don't know exactly where to kind of, this is where I get a little, the wheels get a little shaky for me in the sense of how to explain something without sounding like a total whack job, right? You know what I'm saying? Like, I know these things happened biblically. I believe in the Bible, and biblically I know these things happened, but I've always struggled with difficulty explaining the battle between the archangel and God and, you know, explaining, you know, and I know that there's a lot of different sects of quote unquote Christianity that like to talk about or misinterpret things in the Bible as angels representing God. Like I know a couple of the, you know, kind of outlying Christian offshoots like to say that the burning bush was an angel sent by God, when we know that that was actually God communicating with Moses, right? So there's a lot out there about it.
Well, okay, there's also, look, let me go back to this. I do believe, and we'll, like I said, we'll have an episode dedicated all to this topic.
Yeah.
But just to give an intro, like a little something to whet people's appetite. There, spiritual warfare is real, and the angels and demons are constantly fighting for the souls of us all the time.
Yeah.
And we can't see, I mean, that's all in this spiritual realm that we don't exist in. We can tap into it every once in a while through prayer and interactions with spiritual beings. Angels are used all the time by God to do tasks that he has for them in this world. And they can appear, and they're not going to possess anyone as far as I know, but they do. They can take different forms and do all kinds of stuff. It's kind of crazy. There's so many tales of encounters with being like like they thought it was a human, but there was something different, and they couldn't figure it out. It was in like trivial times or chaotic times or whatever. So, I mean, there's lots of stories about stuff like that. And there's near death encounters and stuff. You got to take into consideration whether or not you believe in that kind of stuff or not too, but
which I sort of dove into a little bit of that as well. Near death encounters. It's very interesting because if you look at a lot of them that happened, these are people that were in different places in the world. Like, I read one that was in Istanbul. I read one that was in France. I read one that was in South America. Yet they all saw something similar.
Well, okay, there's a bunch of psychologically stuff that the secular psychological will toss that around and use a lot of big words to debunk that. Because those images and stuff are stuff we're grown up around and all kinds of, I won't get into that, but what I will say though, what is something that I've seen a lot of is either someone who was in witchcraft, who was a witch, their family was a witch. That was like something they grew into, especially this one lady from, South America, I think, or maybe even Mexico, but like her whole families have been witches and all that stuff. And that's what they did. They did witchcraft and all that kind of stuff. And she converted to Christianity and she told her whole thing and it was unreal. There's been many, 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 you could find these all over the internet about testimonies from people who were in the satanic church that eventually converted to Christianity. And you hear their testimony, you hear what they saw and hear what they did. So there's a lot of things that all these different people share in common and whatever, but also too, there's a lot of things they don't. And there's some of it's very vivid in, you know, a little different ways. There's even a book, I forgot who the author is. He wrote this. He said he was taken to hell to see what it was about. And he wrote a whole book. I think it was called 23 Minutes in Hell or something like that. And I don't know. That's one of those things where I'm not sold on that. There's some interesting stuff behind that. But anyway, there's like a lot of things to do with that particular subject about. But one thing that gets really tossed around a lot is like who are angels? What are angels? What are demons? What are the, and it gets all over the place as far as stuff goes. So
very much does.
I want to take some time and dig into it in deep and see what I can find out really. And I have done this before. This is not the first time, but it'd be interesting to kind of take another swing at it and see where I come up.
Well,
with.
You know, and something else I would warn people of is on the other half of it, the demon half of it. You know, one of the wisest things I ever heard was from Billy Graham. And he said that angels and demons are not flying around with wings and they're beautiful. They make themselves beautiful to you. The devil is not pitchforks and vibrated tail and, you know, all those things. Not. It's very much, you know, one of the things I would tell people is the devil is the person sitting across the table from you that is saying something to you that you absolutely in your heart of hearts know is unequivocally wrong, but he's saying it in such a way that you're thinking about believing him.
Well, and
or her,
to, and for that let matter. Me say to that subject, like when I said, I don't recall having a demonic encounter, and I thought about that actually. That's not true. I know I have. There's been many people, or many times when I've shook somebody's hand or been around somebody, I'm like, there's something wrong with that dude. For instance, and I won't say where this was. I will say it was a church leader, and I will say it was a pastor at a church. I went to this service with, and I was. And it was just, he got up to speak. It was, seemed really odd to me. It was different. And then there was like this thing afterwards and I went up to meet him and I shook his hand and immediately I was like, no, something right here. Right. So there's been a lot of those. And I should say those may be, but I don't know for sure, but I'm saying that could be that too. Right. There could be some kind of thing going on. Right. So, I wanted to clarify that too, by the way, because when I say never, that's not really, and I didn't know or whatever. Well, there's been many times when that could have been.
Well, and there's been arguments made that when you are truly filled with the Holy Spirit, that it gives you a sense of good and evil, right?
Yeah, you so, should. Because you know, again, the Holy Spirit and demonic forces are not compatible.
Yeah.
They can't be
living in y'all at the same time.
No. And they don't want to be around each other, right? Yeah. So, you know, that's, yeah, if you're going to get a feeling, you know, if you're, let me say this again, I'm not some continuous spiritual gift person. We all know, we all discussed that. I'm really not that. But I will say, though, that you should, if you're walking the walk, you should have, like, you should have these things, like sensing, that kind of stuff, that something should make you feel uneasy when you're around something that is not godly.
Well, I mean, one of the great examples I saw, there was a, and I'll try to find the YouTube video. I watched this about 4 years ago. And there was a ghost hunter. He was a pretty famous ghost hunter. And there was a mission worker. And they were having a debate. And the ghost hunter kept saying over and over again, but there are ghosts. There are people's spirits who are at unrest. And the missionary looked him right in the eye and goes, you got to understand. There is no purgatory with Christ. He goes, so if you're running into something that's trying to convince you that it's in purgatory, he goes, it's the devil or a demon. He goes, it's just that simple.
Yeah, it's not the other way around.
He goes, angels don't torture people with things like that. They are very mission-oriented and tasked to what God sends them to do. He goes, if you are running into situations where supernatural things are manifesting to you, they are probably demons or the devil. And he said it in a way that I was like, he was just very matter of fact. And the ghost hunter just couldn't comprehend that, well, maybe there was a spirit with unfinished business. And the missionary said, God's plan is finite. And it when it's done, it's done. There is no coming back for unfinished business.
Again, right? Jesus says, if you are lukewarm, he will spit you out.
Yeah.
You're hot or cold.
Yeah.
In the middle, same thing. Yeah. You're cold. Done. So that really, you can take that, and it doesn't matter how you translate that either. It still comes out to mean the same thing. Like, you don't want to be in that middle ground where you're kind of wishy-washy on following Christ or not. And it's only one or two outcomes. You're either with him or you're not. There's really not a middle. There's not a middle ground, period. It's black and white. God doesn't operate too many gray zones, man. I mean, it's either holy or it's not. I mean, there's no well, it's sort of holy. There's no sort of holy. It's holy or it's not. I mean,
well, I think people mistake ritual for holiness too. I mean, you think about a lot of the churches that have all these rules and regulations. We're going to do this and you have to be this, and that's not God. That's, your ritual is not holy. And I hate to be the guy that informs people of that, but your ritual is not holy, right? No ritual is holy.
No.
You know, so when you're, you know, I've always felt my relationship with God is very organic because he's built into me, right? So it's very natural that we jive together and we're walking down that same path. You know, there's a very... You know, I listened to another very interesting sermon where a gentleman talked about the spirit-shaped hole or the God-shaped hole, right? Like, the reason why people fail by trying to fill their lives with, like, addiction and things like that is they're trying to put a devil-shaped hole into a God-shaped hole. And they're not going to fit, no matter how hard you try. He says, when you were a kid and you had the little box set where you could put the square and the circle and the star and the triangle in, he said, it didn't matter how hard you banged that star, it wasn't going in the triangle. How hard you banged that square, it wasn't going in the circle, right? You might get the corner of it to get in there and it might feel like it fits a little bit, but it's not, it doesn't.
And hello, that was a small break. Actually, quite a large break.
He's smoking a butt.
Yeah, I have to. I have some meat on the smoker that I had to attend to.
And I'm always early to the party, so the smoker meat cannot be a disgraced before tomorrow. So I can't fill my gullet full of smoker meat. Sorry.
Indeed.
Anyway, something else I want to talk about this week, man. And I've just been getting bombarded with this. Man, is fear. Just fear. We live in such a fearful world. It's amazing to me.
No, we don't.
Well, I'll give you an example. You ready? All right. So I'm going to prove you wrong. I prove you wrong. All right. So an untold relative. I won't name names just to be nice, and they're probably going to know who I'm talking about anyway if they watch this. So, an untold relative told me this week that they feared the return of God, even though they were Christians and they weren't outside of the circle of Christ. So whatever that means in their mind, as opposed to what it actually means, I'll have to get deeper into that. And that, that fear has been brought on by the literal bombardment of apocalyptic hot bucket of garbage that has been put out there. I had a fear of dying conversation with somebody this week. They had informed me that they truly feared dying. And this is a healthy mid-40s individual that I talked to this week that just was like, I'm very scared of dying. Mm. And I was like, really? Really? You're healthy. You're somewhat strong and competent, but you're afraid of death. And I just can't.
Okay, let me say this.
You know,
if I used to feel the same way, like what, and not in like a fear death, but I would wonder like, what, if I was dying or knew it was coming, yeah. What would I feel? What would I feel at the moment? Right. So, there's one instance in particular I can point directly to. I remember it plain as day. It was winter. There was a lot of snow. I was in a two-wheel drive pickup truck that I haven't bought tires for in a very long time because I was poor at the time. And I remember being on the highway and my truck just lost it and started doing this number, right? And I was trying to get it under control. I ended up was like doing this, then doing this. And eventually I was like, you know what? This may be it, because I was, you know, wasn't going, you know, really, really fast, but I was going fast enough where it was like, if I hit something, it's over. So I remember swirling around, doing a bunch of stuff, trying to control it. And I remember thinking to myself, well, this is it. I did. This is it. And I felt no fear, no anxiety. I didn't feel any of that. And when I thought I was facing the imminent, my imminent end, because that's me. And that was before I'd really like started really walking with Christ in a very deliberate manner too, you know?
Yeah.
So I think it's all about your perspective on things, but also too, like being a Christ follower, I think that's only like doubled down for me. I mean, I'm just not, it just doesn't enter my mind about an anxiety about now. My anxiety, let me say this, is for like, well, what am I going to do forever? how am I going to, you know, what's it going to be like? It can't be like this, you know, but that stuff doesn't, at the end of the day, it doesn't even.
You're going to poof cigars made of clouds. And
I mean, am I going to be, you know, it's just, those are all questions that really don't matter. Cause I mean, you're talking about an infinitely powerful, infinitely, just insurmountable, indescribable being that. So I was like, well, whatever. But so I just say that, you know, there is a question about that for a lot of people, but I think that really comes down to why, where's the fear coming from? Because if we listen to the word that Jesus is talking about and his apostles and all the teaching that is around the sanctification and redemption and restoration and the rescue of yourself through the life, death, and resurrection of Jesus Christ, and you've accepted that and you're trying to walk that walk, then what's making you have this fear when it's supposed to take the sting of death away? That's the question.
Well,
there's a faith issue probably.
Well, it's different for me. And I'll tell you why.
You have a faith issue? Is that what you're saying?
No, no, not at all. But it's different for me in the sense of I grew up in pretty much for a good period of time, the worst possible environment temporary homelessness because my mother was whacked out. She wouldn't tell anybody. We'd sleep in the car for weeks at a time. And, you know, sometimes she'd go home to my grandparents and I'd get safety. But I don't even think, saying this out loud, I don't even think my grandfather ever knew about this. Pops, if you're watching the show, surprise. And going through all the unsurety of my mother's mental issues and my dad kind of being absent for reasons uncontrollable to him. When you live most of your life afraid as a kid, it takes a sting of fear away as an adult. I don't really fear anything. I don't fear death. I don't feel sickness. I don't fear sickness. I don't fear. And as a younger man, a lot of it was about, I was surviving, I'm strong, Adrian. Like, you know, and then now it's, look, if God brought me through all this to bring me here, then he's probably got a plan for me. And honestly, if that plan ends in 30, 40 years, or that plan ends tomorrow, I'm kind of excited to see what the result of the plan is.
Well, I think you just said it. It boils down to your life experience dictates kind of what your whole perspective about your end would be. Yeah. You know, like for me, it's not probably as dramatic, but I mean, there's still been some significant trauma that I've gone through. And like, I don't, so like getting hurt doesn't, I'm not fearful of that. Mm-hmm. What I'm more fearful of is it's not so much getting hurt. It's like, well, what will I not be able to do
when I'm hurt? Will I be able to smoke pipes and cigars?
Well, no, it's like what, like if I, like, for instance, doing all the wood, chainsaws and, you know, saw work and axes and everything else.
Yeah.
Okay. So if I really cut my leg really bad, which is common, you know, and I had to be like off of my leg for a while, could I put my kids to bed like I want to? Could I, you know, that's the kind of thing that I think about, not really hurting my leg, but deeper than that, but I guess fear, all fear leads to death. Like the fear is really tied to how close that gets you to death is from,
well, let's psychologically. Be clear also, fear biblically is a punishment from God. Yeah. I mean, I can, here, let me, I've got my sources.
Mm.
Let me lay it on you, bro, man.
I'd like to hear it.
All right. So let's look at the regular dictionary definition of fear. An unpleasant emotion caused by the belief that someone or something is dangerous, likely to cause pain or a threat, or to be afraid of someone or something as likely to be dangerous, painful, or threatening. What is the Bible definition of fear? Fear is the natural consequence of sin. Genesis 3:10, 4:13, and 14, Proverbs 28:1.
But
it comes as a punishment. Deuteronomy 28:25-28, the fear of a man and of evils are dangers to be avoided, from which the fear of God delivers. Numbers 14:9, 21-34, Psalms 23:4, 31-14.
Well, this is why I said this is a deeper topic than what we should probably be talking
about.
But
I'm not trying to get deep into it, but biblically, fear is like a punishment for sin.
There's only one good fear that's in the Bible, even with all the what the verses you said, fear of God. That's the only healthy fear that is. But
there's also healthy fear.
No.
Like,
there's not.
I don't want to put my hand in the wood chipper to see if it works.
But that's just not, that's just like being wise, dude. That's not fear. Like, you know, like fear of God is the only one in biblical text that is looked at in a positive nature.
Yeah, but I think when they mean by punishment of fear, I think punishment for sin is the fear that sin will have a negative impact or blowback.
But again, that's fear of God.
Yeah.
Okay. So it's not necessarily the fear of whatever. It's the fear of fear of what happens
fear of retribution
from God. Yeah. Right. Mm-hmm. But if we're in New Testament times, there's no retribution.
Okay. Bible scholar. Got a question for you. This one was posed to me this week by another person I spoke to that hasn't subscribed, but they said they would watch. I showed them a little bit of one of our episodes. And I asked them, I said, what would you like to know? And she said, how is it fair that a man can be evil all his life up until his last breath and in his dying breath call out to God and not pay a price for everything that he did for the entirety of his life?
Fair to who?
It's just fair in general.
But see, that's a... No, that doesn't work. I'll say this why. That's looking at it from a human perspective, saying what's fair and what's just and everything else. And we don't have a proper view of what's just and what's fair.
But you understand the question.
I understand the question very clearly. But I'm saying throughout...
But also take into consideration, this person that I was talking to is not a person of faith.
Understood. And right? I mean, this is the same thing, like, why does God do bad things to good people? Kind of nonsense.
I actually don't think that they're quite the same question. Yeah, I think kinda it kind of comes from a different place.
Because you're aligning a earthly-centered view about fairness. So, because if you're looking at it from the point of view that this life is all there is, then yeah, that's a, you know, there's a justice that needs to be served or whatever, but it's not. This is all in preparation for an eternity.
Okay.
Okay. So it's looking at this and saying, well, if some guy was evil his whole life and he had a change of heart, well, for one thing, that is incredible. Let me just say that is spectacularly incredible to have like somebody like that. And I've never known somebody who's been like a real evil, like personally, who's been a real evil son of a bitch and who's all of a sudden at, you know, tail end of his life is make the switch. Cause remember, it's not just saying Jesus is okay. I believe in Jesus now. You have to have a heart change. It has to be a complete decision that I am not enough. He is, I now will follow his path. Okay. So, I really, if that dude has like lived his life in a evil manner and all of a sudden has had this experience or whatever, and that's unbelievable. That's awesome. Okay. But I'm not looking at that from a fairness for this particular period of time I'm on earth. Like I'm looking at it as like, holy cow, that's something moved dramatically in order for this guy to have such a heart change at regardless of where he is. Right.
Do you believe that some of those outcryings are not a change of heart, but are fear?
Yeah.
Of death?
Sure. I mean, it depends on.
Well, I mean, and I'll use my grandmother as an example. She was not. She never portrayed godliness. She's a great woman, loving woman. Died of lung cancer from smoking herself to death. But apparently she called for a minister right before she died. Now I wasn't there for that, but I was told clearly about it. And, I was asked by a relative, do you think that your grandmother went to heaven? And you know anything about me, Reggie? I am a realist. And I said, that is between her and God.
And it is.
I was like, I can't tell you that. Whatever confession or forgiveness went on in the presence of that minister, I don't know. I wasn't there. I didn't hear if she had an epiphany or a God moment. I call them God moments. I have them all the time. God moments where I'm screwing up or I'm trying to figure something out and God kind of brings me in and says, all right, here's what you need to do. And I got ostracized by that relative for a while because I said that. I didn't say she didn't. I just said, I don't know her relationship with God at the moment she passed. And I don't know what given thing happened between her and the minister and what that conversation manifested into. So I can't really clearly answer that question. I can say, I hope she did.
But yeah, that's the right answer, dude. I mean, you don't know, and you're not going to know. The Bible, God says in the Word, only He is the ultimate judge and juror of everything, right? He's the one who's going to tell about everything, and He's got perfect justice.
Yeah.
Perfect justice, something we have no idea about. So when somebody's talking about fairness and everything else, we don't have a freaking clue. I mean, We mess everything up, and our version of justice, our version of fairness is garbage.
That we do. We mess everything
up. So I'm not worried about I'm not really worried about if anybody win or what they've done or whatever. I mean, look, Christ died for everybody's sin if they so choose to pick up their cross and follow him. So, I mean, yeah, that's okay, fairness to who? I don't really care if it's fair to me. I don't care if fair to you. What I care is if God sees and God judges that and does the whatever he's going to do. And I don't even know that.
Yeah.
And you can't say that that's a hypothetical situation that who knows what this so-called dude who's been evil, quote unquote, her evil may have been he's a Christian. you know what I mean? I mean, like, so the answer really is that we don't make those decisions. God does. And we don't see life as a period of, you know, whatever to how many years we're on this earth. It's from here. This is just a blip of eternity that we have to deal with.
I like it.
And again, good answer. If somebody like Pablo Escobar.
I like how you pulled Pablo Escobar out. Like,
I was trying to think of something.
You weren't like David Duke or Pablo Escobar.
I don't know that just why that came to my, but how much what he did, right? Oh,
murdered.
Yeah.
Hundreds, maybe thousands of people.
Well, before he died, if he has some kind of heart-changing epiphany, I would like lift that up.
Yeah.
But there's also story. Look, here's the thing. There's African voodoo doctors. I know of one particular story I read that was he mutilated little boys and stuff for power.
Yeah.
Did himself. Spent time in prison for it. And ended up pastoring a church. That's powerful. That's saying that, look, you can be lower than excrement as far as most people are concerned.
Wasn't it Paul that, I might be wrong, crucified Christians?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Saul was there at the stoning of Stephen.
Yeah.
Maybe even incited it to go on kind of thing. Yeah, of course, that's what he did.
Yeah.
Paul's the biggest example of a person who persecuted Christians and everything. But I'm saying even a more modern example of these voodoo tribes people in Africa who like think that, you know, they mutilate and murder all kinds of kids for power. And, you know, they if that kind of person can come around, I'm overjoyed that evil has been turned around. Mm-hmm. And it's a testimony for everybody else to say, look, man, I don't think you're going to, you know, as far as humans are concerned, you're not going to do too many things like that's worse than this. And you can come out of it. And nice. He's greater than that nonsense you've just committed. That's beautiful, man.
Dig it.
Yeah.
Dig it.
Another thing about fear is I watched the whole series on Fallout, the Amazon show. Uh-huh. Not that I know. I don't think you have, but. What's interesting is about how they depict like this apocalyptic event. You have these, what they call vault dwellers who yep. live in these vaults. And then you have the people who live in the real world,
the ruins,
the ruins.
Yes.
But how they portray, and I'm talking the show now, cause I didn't play the game actually at all. I don't think maybe tried it for like a minute, but I didn't. But in the show, I mean, it's a very much a strong, you know, the strong leads the, you know, the weak, and you know, you got to care for yourself. I don't think that's an accurate depiction of an apocalyptic outcome. And I'll say why.
Mm-hmm.
We spent how many thousands of years working towards civilization. You know, we've grown from cave dwelling, hunter gatherers to agriculture to having civilized societies and stuff, right? That you're not going to just erase that overnight. And I would say that most people, when they get into a situation, sure, there's going to be some chaos and there's going to be some that take advantage of the situation. But I think in general, it's not going to end up like that scenario where you just have total lawlessness going on.
Well, let's be clear what the word apocalypse means. Apocalypse means the end of all things.
So it's not really an end of all things. It's the end of most things.
It's just the end of everything. Like, right? Like the destruction of everything. So I think, you know, take Mad Max as an example. He survived the apocalypse. No, it's the apocalypse, dude. You didn't survive. Nobody survived. It was the apocalypse. The only reason people and things survived when Jesus wiped the earth clean with Noah was because that was his will for those things to survive and those people to survive. Right? But truly, for an apocalyptic event to happen, nobody's surviving, right? No one.
But I'm saying it doesn't eradicate. So if you have something that almost is an apocalypse, like Fallout.
Is that like being kind of pregnant?
Yeah. Like everything's destroyed. Everybody goes, you know, there's irradiated ground and all this kind of stuff. You're still going to have goodness.
Yeah.
Like let's say that's not the end of the whole freaking world and we're not raptured and all this, which I don't want to get into, but, you know, there's going to still be people who have a sense of morality.
Yes.
And a matter of fact, communities cannot grow without it.
A sense of being centered on
some survival some and principles. Helping others survive. Yeah, there has to be that, right? So
yes.
You're not even, I mean, that's what I mean. You're going to have like, you would have something like, but it wouldn't look, I don't think it would look like that. Now, I do admire the 50s aesthetic. I think that's amazing.
That is pretty cool.
It is so cool. Yeah. And I keep wondering, like, why did we ever leave that? Like, that was really neat. It looks so much better than the crap we have today.
It does. It's much cleaner, much nicer, much more even keel. Like, people, I think one of the things that frustrates me is people take for granted, like, a cell phone has more computing power than the first rocket that went to the moon, right?
Well, no, all the computers that were in NASA at the time.
Yeah.
Your phone is like 100 times more powerful than.
Yeah.
Or something like. It's ridiculous.
Yeah. You know, they had televisions back then in black and white, right? So they.
With a tube that had to warm up.
Yeah. I mean, it's a very. The comparative is very different in the sense that, you know, in that time, family and family engagement and family interaction was highly prized. Now, you know, I saw an example of this the other day. I was helping a friend of mine do a job, and we walked into this room. They were moving an elderly person to an assisted living facility, and several members of the family were all there. And these were generations, like the grandfather, the father, the son, the daughter, like all different generations, years apart. All of them staring at their cell phone, none of them talking to each other.
Yeah, that's ridiculous.
And they were less than 6 feet from each other.
Yeah.
And I felt so sad because I was like, just the generational wisdom your father has to pass on to your generation, you should throw that phone in the toilet and flush it and shut up and let that man talk.
Dude, there's been, I don't know, there's more than like 3 or 4 times where me and my family's been out to eat.
Mm-hmm.
And we don't look at our phones while we're eating. We don't do that. We're interacting with each other and all that stuff. I've had more than 3 or 4 people come up and say, hey, I just want to say how much we thought it was cool that you guys weren't just staring at your phones.
Yeah.
Like, it's a thing. And we just don't. We don't do that. We prize the time we have. And especially when we're out to dinner and my kids are like excited about whatever and all this stuff. I'm like, I want to hear it.
They're excited about the 2 things that they're going to get off the menu because they don't like anything else. So.
Well, then we're convincing him like, oh, but I think you're going to really like, you might really like this. Daddy, yeah. I don't want to try. Just come on. You know,
just take one bite and you're going to love it.
I know. And like, so like getting him to try a taco.
Yeah.
A taco, dude. Like everybody loves freaking tacos, right? Like getting him to try a taco was a bear. And finally, when they did, they're like, oh, that's really good. I told you.
I've been telling you for years. I've been
telling you now. But, you know, that's.
I'm trying to convince my youngest boy that everything doesn't have to be buffalo flavored.
Well, that's true, but.
You know.
I mean, buffalo flavored is awesome. Now, don't get me wrong, but I don't like everything being buffalo flavored.
I like buffalo, but I don't want like my eggs buffaloed.
Yeah,
and
No.
You know, I don't like my spaghetti buffaloed, and just wings are good occasionally. Everything else can just hang off to the side.
I hear you. So I did go to this week. I went to a place called. I went with my brother up to pick up a base that was way up in. It was about a 4-hour drive away. I was just working on my phone, doing meetings and stuff for my phone and everything. We stopped at this place and called Uranus Fudge Factory. Yep. Now it actually does sell fudge and all this stuff. But they go with that Uranus motif with everything. Like, we pump in the front and pack in the rear. Right? And it's like all this stuff, like, dig deeper in Uranus for the whatever. It's crazy how
much. It's kind of like butt drugs.
Oh, my God. Yeah, it was, dude, it's just the whole thing, right? But they had, like, all these things they make themselves. Like, they had, like, a pumpkin butter and, like, a cherry butter and, like, all their own preserves that weren't sweetened with, but they were just sweetened with juice and not sugars and all this kind of stuff. And made their own popcorn and just a whole thing of fudge you could get. So I was happy to give them lots of money for things that they did without all this nonsense. That was really cool, man.
You heard it here first, folks. Uranus Fudge Factory.
Mm-hmm.
You got to give me that place so I can take the kids there. They'll just giggle the whole time we're there.
Your boys will have a ball, bro. Yeah. Well, and it's small. It's not like it's that big where you're going to waste. But it is fun to go in there and, like, this stuff is really good, too. So you wouldn't waste your time, like, just driving. But only – I wouldn't say, like, you want to take a trip there just to go there because it's, like, a couple hours away, you know.
Yeah.
That was interesting.
Uranus Fudge Factory.
Yeah. Yeah,
that's a little weird.
It is, dude. And they just rolled with it, you know, the whole time, man.
They're probably making money hand over fist.
Probably. Right. I don't know. All right, Brian. I think I'm going to call this one.
All right.
Done.
Guys, like, subscribe, Yelp, Google review, write us a letter,
carrier pigeon,
smoke signal. You can open your window and yell if you want. I'm not sure if we'll hear you, but
we're trying.
But most of all, the most important one, subscribe. I'm Brian. This is Reggie.
Hello.
And we've been R&B Talks. See you guys.
Bye-bye.